All right. One thing I wanted to say before I dive into the physics was just a couple of comments about next semester. Some of you may be considering taking the sequel to this course. One thing that might be a barrier for some of you is the fact that you've probably already noticed there's a pretty high homework load in this course. And a lot of that is because we're building so many tools this semester, like with Green's functions and so on, and boundary value problems, solutions. And I did want to stress that next semester's course has a lot less homework load. I don't know, somewhere between 50 and 60% probably of what it is this semester. So if that's a consideration, you might want to consider it. But anyway, I do encourage you. There's a lot of interesting, important physics in that. And if you don't take it next semester because of your own course constraints, I hope you consider taking the second semester, 631, at some point in your graduate studies. A lot of interesting physics there. All right, so we started this discussion having a chunk of matter, and we're going to apply electric fields to it and see how it responds. How do you even think about electric fields and how they are affected by matter and how the fields affect the matter? So the basic idea that I started talking about last time is that matter gets rearranged, the charges in matter get rearranged or polarized when you apply external fields to it, and the polarization then induces additional fields. After the charges rearrange, those contribute their own electric fields. And the total field at any point in the material or outside of the material will be the sum of the external and the internal fields. And if we think that, a chunk of matter, right, it has, of course, at the atomic level, at the angstrom level, it's got lots of particles at very small scale. But we're not so much interested in the fields on the angstrom scale, but more sort of on an average. And that's the words I think in Jackson that we have to average over a microscopically large but macroscopically small volume. Reminds me of when I teach the Fermi Golden Rule in quantum mechanics. A lot of you have probably heard of that or seen it before. You have to take an interesting limit that you let the you let the time go to infinity, but it can't be too big. Okay, so let's imagine that in the material we will call E micro, like the primitive or the microscopic electric field. And of course, we think that this is the quantity that really obeys Maxwell's equations, ignoring things like field quantization and stuff like that, staying classical for now. But this really obeys our original Maxwell equations for free space. And includes, in essence, all the charges in the universe are contributing. And this would be fluctuating wildly if you really could go down at the microscopic level inside a material to the angstrom or subangstrom level and really measure things on that spatial scale or measure things on the attosecond time scale. You would see these wild fluctuations like inside a solid. So what we want is something different. We want to be thinking of a coarse-grained or averaged electric field. And we can think of this mathematically as maybe picking a spherical volume centered on some point, like I've drawn here, that might have 1,000 atoms, and we could average the field, the microscopic field, over that volume. So let's talk about what happens when you do that. First point, first observation is that the curl, when we are talking about a static situation, a time-independent, time-average situation, since the microscopic field in electrostatics has no curl, and we have linear equations, that means we will still have curl of our coarse-grained electric field still has no curl. This leads to a first conclusion. As you know, if you have no curl, you can set the electric field to be the negative of the gradient of a scalar potential. We can still do that even in media, even in the presence of matter. Second point is we need to determine the internal field's contribution. Which is the main point of really this whole chapter. And primarily, you can think of this as being created by the electric dipole moments that are induced in the medium. Which we were starting this chapter talking about quite a bit. Think you apply your field to this medium, like external field, connect it to a battery or a power supply. You're going to make a slight rearrangement of the charges in this volume, and that's going to produce its own fields now. These new dipole moments that are induced. And we'll assume that the higher multiples, because we saw this whole multiple expansion, we'll assume that those just maybe small corrections. But the main physics comes from the dipoles. And so let's start from the electrostatic potential due to dipoles we've already been introduced to in this chapter. For that electrostatic potential due to one dipole moment, P is P dot x minus x prime over 4 pi epsilon naught x minus x prime distance cubed. So that's for a dipole at x prime produces an electrostatic potential at a point x. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is you can rewrite this, and actually that's the point also of homework 4.2. You can actually write this potential as due to an effective charge. There's a rho effective, and you can think that the dipole, I forget, let's see, what was the formula? Something like minus P gradient of the Dirac delta function? Was it something like that? X naught? I think it was something like that. So it's kind of like the dipoles act as though they are a new source of charge in the material. So if now we think, okay, we're coarse graining, so we want to think not maybe of the individual dipoles, of the individual atoms or molecules in the medium, but we want to kind of start thinking just the way we do of charges, which are all discrete charges in nature. We want to think that there are so many dipoles, maybe in a macroscopic material, that we want to have a density of dipoles. Okay, so let's imagine, thinking a little bit more continuously now, that we can go to differential form, which will allow us to introduce a density of dipoles. Let's see if I can get this idea across. So let's say there's the potential d phi, which is produced by a dipole, differential dipole dp at the point x prime. Okay, let's write what that would look like. Just a straightforward generalization of this formula. We can write it as d phi at x as this differential dipole moment at x prime over 4 pi epsilon naught. And then I'm going to rewrite this x minus x prime over the distance cubed as the primed gradient of 1 over x minus x prime. Which is also minus dp dotted into over 4 pi epsilon naught times the unprimed gradient of 1 over x minus x prime. It's useful to keep in mind that we could write the gradient either way on this expression. So now if we imagine there is, as we move through the material, some changing density of dipoles perhaps, we can introduce a polarization density. which plays a crucial role in the rest of the discussion. So now we're going to go to this continuum limit. We can write then that dp of x prime is equal to the density, capital P, at that point, times the differential volume element at that point. And this capital P of x prime is what we call the polarization density, or just the polarization when we're being a little lazier. Okay, again, it's the average dipole moment per unit volume. One way to think of it, if you have, let's say, a density of molecules with number density ni, for molecule type I, it's that number density, which is a number of molecules per unit volume, times the average dipole moment for that ith type of molecule. That's one way to think of this polarization vector. Guess I might as well write it. The number density of the ith molecule is this ni. And pi is the average dipole moment of that type. Okay, so we want to get to the macroscopic modifications of Maxwell's equations that result from this picture. One thing I should maybe mention right now is, of course, we're kind of talking about this as though we don't know about quantum mechanics at this level. But later, well, you'll see in your quantum courses, you can calculate these dipole moments and to varying degrees of approximation. Okay. But now what I want to argue is that, of course, we could have in a material both actual free charges that can roam. There might be electrons roaming around separate that are not stuck in atoms or molecules and in bound states. But we could also have free charge present, and the bound charges that produce this polarization effect. But for now, I'm just going to talk about the dipoles, but we'll bring in the free charges in it shortly. Okay, so let's revise this formula for phi of x, write our coarse-grained phi of x now. due to the dipoles. So we can write it as a volume integral of our polarization density, capital P of x prime, over 4 pi epsilon naught, dotted into the primed gradient of 1 over the distance, x to x prime, d cubed x prime. And as Jackson likes to do, we're going to work on this with some identities. And it's going to teach us something, rewriting that in a different form. And the identity I want to remind you of, it's basically the three-dimensional version of the chain rule, if you like. The divergence of this quantity, the prime divergence, of P of x prime over the distance basically, you'll have a term where you have the divergence of P prime times the undifferentiated 1 over distance, but then you'll also have P of x prime dotted into the gradient of 1 over x minus x prime, right? So that's the identity, that this is del prime dot P of x prime. Over the distance, undifferentiated distance, and then we have P of x prime times the into the primed gradient 1 over x minus x prime. And we're going to plug that into our previous integral over there. Because what's in the integral is just this term here. Right? So we can rewrite this term as the left-hand side minus this del prime dot p term. Okay, let's do the math. We have our obligatory 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. We have the volume integral now of del prime dotted into P of x prime over the distance x to x prime, d cubed x prime. And now we'll have minus this term, minus the volume integral d cubed x prime over 4 pi epsilon naught del prime dot p of x prime over the distance. And in this first term, we see a divergence of the whole integrand inside the full integrand. And whenever we see that in a volume integral, it makes us want to do what? What'd you say? Which theorem? Divergence theorem, right. So that turns this first integral into a surface integral now. And let's write that, which is an important formula. Phi of x is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. The volume integral still remains of minus del dot p of x prime. Del prime dot p of x prime over the distance we still have that term, which is still a volume integral, d cubed x prime. But now we have the surface integral, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, integral over the surface of p of x prime, dotted into the normal, outward normal at the surface, dA prime, over the distance, x minus x prime. And now we can interpret this. We're starting to see math that looks very similar, resembling some of the formulas we had with free charges before, which was the point of this derivation, that we can put fields produced by dipoles in a form that looks very much in parallel with the math we had for charges before. Okay. So in particular, we can interpret the two terms as potential produced by a type of charge. We could call it a volume bound charge, which would be defined as minus del prime dotted into our polarization density at any point in the volume. This behaves just like any other charges in the way it produces electrostatic potential. And, or, we could say we have a surface bound charge, defined as sigma B is polarization density dotted into n hat prime. That behaves just like, in the way it produces a potential, just as though they were free charges on a surface, like on a conducting surface or something like that. So with these reinterpretations, we can simply take the math we had done before. In particular, we can write the formula we had before for the electrostatic potential. Let me remind you, our old formula now has a new meaning. Our old formula was phi of x is the volume integral of rho of x prime, d cubed x prime, over 4 pi epsilon naught distance, minus x prime. And if there were surface charges, we would have a surface integral, sigma of x prime d area prime over 4 pi epsilon naught x minus x prime. And the point is, this still is the correct formula. Provided we set rho here of x prime to be the free charge rho, the actual charges that you might be able to control, you know, with sending electrons or protons into the material could have some free charges there. But we have to add to that in this bound charge, rho b of x prime. If we do that, this volume integral still works. It's still our potential. And the negative gradient of that is still our electric field. And similarly, sigma of x prime, we have to now interpret as the free charges on the surface, if they are present, plus the bound charges on the surface caused by the polarization. And again, rho bound minus the divergence of P, and sigma bound is plus P dot n hat. Well, prime. Okay, so let's turn that into a Maxwell equation that will be relevant in actual macroscopic media, a chunk of material. So we know that minus del squared phi, which is also equal to the divergence of the electric field. By definition, we said this relation between E is minus del phi is still relevant in the presence of matter. This is now 4 pi over 4 pi epsilon naught, then rho free plus rho bound. And I can rewrite that if I plug in what rho bound is as del dot E plus 1 over epsilon naught del dot into the polarization density is equal to the free charges only, free charge density only divided by epsilon naught. And now at this point, the convention is to introduce this as the divergence of one quantity on the left-hand side called the electric displacement. Which is epsilon naught E plus P. So it has the dimensions, the units of the polarization density, or the units of epsilon naught times the electric field. And with that definition, we have a very simple new Maxwell equation. Del dot D is rho free. Jackson doesn't use this free notation. He just says del dot D is rho. So when you see rho in Jackson, he's talking about rho free. So don't lose sight of that. And there is then a Gauss's law by integrating right both sides and applying the divergence theorem. There is the closed integral over a surface of D dotted into the differential area element will equal the total free charge enclosed inside that volume. Okay, so these are two key equations. and this plus the equation we said still holds, del cross E is 0. These two equations define the electric field. The new form of our two Maxwell equations for electrostatics in the presence of media. Now, in general, we can't actually solve these equations without knowing something else. So, basically, we have two different quantities in these partial differential equations. We can't really solve them until or unless someone gives us some information about how D in the material is related to E. Now that can vary. There's not one answer that works for all materials. In some materials they're related in one way, in other materials they can be related in a different way. And that comes down to, well, you're not probably won't be surprised, there are very different types of materials out there. But one thing that you might imagine that we know, especially now in hindsight from what we know about quantum mechanics, is that the electric fields inside an atom and a molecule that are making up the matter that actually bind the electrons in those systems to the nuclei, they are of the order of 10 to the 9 volts per centimeter. These are huge, huge, huge electric fields. And so it might not be any real surprise, again, from quantum mechanics, that taking an E field of 1 volt per centimeter, or even 100 volts per centimeter, maybe even 1,000 volts per centimeter, this is a weak field compared to the fields inside the atom. And then you can kind of imagine perturbation theory is going to work pretty darn well. And you can use quantum perturbation theory applied to a molecule. Let's take a molecule. That's as good as I can do. We're going to apply a field to it. It's going to induce a dipole moment. And it's not going to maybe be a huge surprise that dipoles induced are to a good approximation proportional to the field. It's what you expect from first order perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. P will be proportional to E. So in the material, let's generalize that idea to the polarization density that the polarization density will look like, of course, it has to have units of epsilon naught times the field, and let's introduce a dimensionless proportionality constant, chi e, that multiplies the electric field. and this chi e is called the electric susceptibility. And if you have an isotropic medium, it'll be some constant. Like a normal solid or liquid, say, it would normally be reasonable approximation to say it's an isotropic medium and it's just some constant. With that definition, we can come back to D and write it as a constant times E, right? Where that constant is defined to be epsilon naught times 1 plus chi e. And that new constant is, of course, has the same physics as the electric susceptibility, but it has a different name, which we call the dielectric constant. Although if you look up dielectric constants in the literature, you'll probably be finding the constants without the epsilon naught. You'll usually find a dimensionless constant, so you'll have to multiply it by epsilon naught if you grab it from Google or the chatbot. So it's kind of amazing to me that, I mean, this level of theory was really already done in the 1800s. Before they knew anything about quantum mechanics, like people often do in physics, if you don't know anything else and you're making a guess, well, that's your first thing you might guess. It's proportionality, a linear relationship between the two quantities. And so they went a long way with that assumption to get Maxwell's equations in the presence of media without knowing quantum mechanics. But quantum mechanics verifies now that this is a sensible thing in a lot of regimes, but it also shows where it breaks down. This proportionality is not exact under all conditions. So there are times when you have to come back to these equations and find a different relation between D and E than what's written over there. You don't always have this linearity. I'll lay out later some of those reasons and situations where it has to be generalized. But let's continue with this line, assuming this situation, and look at one important special case. Where epsilon is simply a constant within some finite volume of space. When that's true, when I take del dot d, the del won't act on epsilon. Of course, if epsilon is changing through space, you can't say that. But in this important special case where epsilon is constant within some volume, then we have simply factor out the epsilon and get a very simple modification of our old Maxwell's equations. Instead of del dot E is rho over epsilon naught, it's now del dot E is rho over epsilon within that region. Very simple modification of the Maxwell equations. And then if you have two regions that are connected, like a glass air interface, for instance. They will have different dielectric constants in the two regions, and we'll have to know how to connect these vector fields across such regions. And so if we have connection here between the two chunks of matter, and these are actually touching without a gap as I've drawn, right? And there is might be a different epsilon 1, epsilon 2, for instance. Then we already know how to derive the boundary conditions. It was already done in section boundary conditions. See section of the text, I.5, already derived these boundary conditions for this version of Maxwell's equations, which is that d2 minus d1 dotted into the unit normal vector going from 1 into 2 at the surface, that difference has to equal the free charges at that surface. And on the other hand, E2 minus E1 crossed into that normal unit vector, which picks up, the cross product picks up all the components orthogonal to the surface, right? The parallel components of the E field, those remain continuous. Whereas the normal components of the D, the electric displacement, could be discontinuous if there are free charges at that surface. Of course, normally, if you put two chunks of matter together, there won't be free charges at that surface, right? So you'll only have bound charges. And that bound charges don't make the electric displacement discontinuous. Yeah. Well, I can just change 1 to 2 everywhere in this equation, and it still holds from 1. If that's, I think, what you want me to do. It's just that this has some sign information, right, in it. And it depends on the unit vector, you know, going from 1 to 2, the sign looks this way. And if you want, you might review that derivation back in section I. It was actually before the chapter before chapter 1, where that was derived basically using a Gaussian pillbox at the surface, the way you always derive these boundary conditions. Okay, so these are going to be crucial when we solve boundary value problems, whenever there are connecting surfaces. But now I should talk a little about the physics of when this linear relation, this proportionality, fails. And one case is a class of materials called ferroelectrics. Ferroelectrics, P can be non-zero even when you turn off the electric field. bar electorate, I think it's called. The analog of a magnet, permanent magnet, but with electric dipoles instead of magnetic dipoles. Another situation is you could go to increasingly strong electric fields applied to the material. You can imagine the quantum mechanics is going to start bringing in physics beyond first order perturbation theory. And in particular, like with lasers nowadays, you can apply an electric field at this level and rip the electrons right out of the atom. Then, of course, this proportionality fails. But even before that, before you get to that strong of a field, there might be quadratic, cubic terms, and so on that matter. And in such cases, you can find that P is a rather complicated nonlinear function of the electric field. This is especially important in the whole field of nonlinear optics. Or, for instance, dielectric breakdown. You apply a big enough voltage to air, it rips out the electrons and makes a lightning bolt. Well, it's true, that's going beyond electrostatics, but in dielectric breakdown, of course, you're seeing a very time-dependent phenomenon, but the magnetic terms, which are normally what you think of as changing Maxwell's equations, those are still largely irrelevant compared to the electric field stuff going on. So there's still some relevance of these equations, even in dielectric breakdown. There is another class of problems, though, it's important to talk about, that is still linear, but a more complicated form of linearity. Right, crystals or many molecules are not symmetric. What's so funny? Yeah? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Good. I like hunger. Hunger is important. So we can have a linear but anisotropic relationship. You might imagine if you have a molecule in some shape, like, CO2, a very linear molecule. You could probably imagine applying an electric field in this direction will produce a different effect than an electric field in this direction. And this type of thing is often written as still a linear relationship, also for something like a crystal, like calcite crystals, be another example, which is birefringent. P could still be written proportional to the electric field, but chi is a tensor now, a 3x3 matrix. you'll see this called in various ways the susceptibility tensor, for instance. A more complicated form of linearity. You can, in other words, you might apply an electric field in this direction and it makes a dipole moment in that direction. Yeah?
Can I subtract directly the birefringency of a material from chi?
Sorry?
So is chi directly related with the birefringency, right? Or not?
Well, yeah, although technically the birefringence is usually talking about light waves. Right. And so then we would need chi e as a function of frequency. We won't encounter that until about chapter 6.
And would be a way that I can subtract the birefringency term directly from chi?
Yeah, I mean, the birefringence is exactly in chi. Yeah. This is enough to predict birefringence. Absolutely. Good question. What?
Like my word degree for my undergrad was on that, and I never figured that out until now.
Oh.
So it is like funny.
Huh.
Because it basically that solved all my problems.
Oh, okay. You wish you had known that.
Yeah, I wish.
So there's.
I suffered that a lot. Yeah.
No, birefringence is a really interesting phenomenon. And complex. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so this is the basic math. And we're taking a course now in electrodynamics. We're still not quite ready for the dynamics. But at least we're Jackson handling the electro stuff. What does he do? He solves boundary value problems. So let's do that. Okay, so boundary value problems. There are different categories. I see I've called this category 1, but for the life of me, I now can't remember what is category 2. But I guess we'll get to that later. Category 1. This is problems solvable by image methods. Just like we had with the microscopic Maxwell's equations, we could solve a class of problems by images when we had a lot of symmetry in the problem. And so let's look at a point charge near a boundary, a planar interface, a flat interface between two dielectrics. Let's call it Q. That's a free charge now. Near a planar interface between two dielectrics. And I'll assume they are linear, homogeneous dielectrics. So epsilon is just a constant, not a tensor. All right, here's our diagram. Just looking head on, here's our planar interface, which I'll say up here is the z direction greater than 0, positive. And in this region, epsilon is equal to epsilon 1, and the electrostatic potential will be phi 1 up here. And that's the side I'll put Q on. The only free charge in the whole universe. And let's put it at a specific point, 0, 0 in the x and y coordinates, and d in the z coordinate. And I'll call that the position of our charge. Then we have the z equals 0 plane. And now we have down here at z less than 0, epsilon will equal a second value, epsilon 2. There will be a different electrostatic potential down here in region 2. And now we're interested actually in calculating phi in both regions. Once we know phi, we can take the negative gradient and get the electric field in each region. But now here's the one tricky thing about this. First, we're going to do the image problem when we're calculating phi 1 up at z greater than 0. So for that case, I'm going to try having an image charge below with allow it to possibly have a different magnitude, Q prime. We're going to have to try it out. This is how image methods work. You try it out. And the simplest thing to try is to put it at the symmetrical point, 0, 0, minus d. Maybe we'll find that doesn't work and we'll have to modify it, but let's try the simplest first thing and see if it leads to any inconsistency. And we'll call that point x naught prime. And again, this is only, this discussion is only when calculating phi 1. Now, why did I say that? Is because when we're calculating phi 2, this bottom region will be our volume of the observation points. And we are never allowed to put an image charge inside our volume where we're doing the calculation. But for the calculation in this upper volume, we are free to stick image charges outside of that volume, if that will help to mimic the boundary conditions we need to describe. Okay, so with that assumption, let's see what if we can get a formula for calculating phi 1 for some value of Q prime. Okay. So phi 1 then would be the sum of the potentials due to the two charges. And in particular, this is a point in region 1, the upper region. And so, if you remember, we'll have del squared phi is rho over epsilon now, minus rho over epsilon. And the solution of that in region 1, where epsilon is equal to epsilon 1, will be this. And similarly, the contribution of the potential due to Q prime will be 4 pi epsilon 1 still. We're still in region 1, even though the image charge is in region 2. X minus x naught prime. So this is the ansatz we're going to try. But we have to know something about the fields in region 2 to go on, because we have a boundary condition that's going to involve D2 minus D1 across this boundary. So we also have to have an ansatz for the potential in region 2. When we're in region 2, this image charge is not here. So we're kind of looking up above the surface from down below. Well, all we see is this Q. So essentially, we should only see the potential due to Q. There's only one term there. And so our ansatz is that phi 2 could be written as 1 over 4 pi epsilon 2, and then maybe some modified version of Q, because we're in this complicated scenario here. We'll call it Q double prime that we still have to find, and divide it by the distance to the real charge. So that's our ansatz. I think it's a plausible ansatz. We don't know yet whether it'll work, though, until we try to impose boundary conditions. But I hope you understand, again, why there's only one term in region 2. We can't have an image charge there. I guess it's possible we'd have to stick another image charge in region 1. One could imagine. If this ansatz fails, we might try that. Calculate phi 2 for a different, not only Q, but maybe another image charge. It'll turn out we don't need that, though. Okay, so let's try to match the boundary conditions. Well, it's going to account for, it just gives us more flexibility. I mean, maybe the first thing to try would be just to keep this as Q prime and see if that, well, no, I guess, yeah, maybe to try a Q prime. I don't know. One could imagine different things to try. We don't know yet how this complicated boundary situation might change the effective charge seen from region 2. That's the point. We don't really know. So we add a little flexibility there. Maybe it'll turn out to equal Q after we do the math. Okay, so now let's see if we can match the boundary conditions with that assumption there, that ansatz. So let's write out some of the geometry we need, like 1 over the distance, x to x naught is x squared plus y squared plus z minus d squared to the minus 1/2, and 1 over x minus x naught prime is x squared plus y squared plus z plus d quantity squared to the minus 1/2. Don't forget x, y, z. These are the observation point that we're interested in. And here there are no free charges. So the boundary conditions have their simplest form, namely d. The z component of D is continuous. So epsilon 1 Ez at z just above the surface has to equal epsilon 2 times the z component of the E field just below the surface at z equals 0 minus. And the x and y components are continuous. I'll just write the x. So, in other words, maybe I'll come over here. Minus epsilon 1 d phi 1 dz at x, y, 0 should better equal minus epsilon 2 d phi 2 dz at x, y, 0. And taking those derivatives, we have minus epsilon 1 for 4 pi epsilon 1, we have plus qd for rho squared plus d squared. If I use x squared plus y squared, call that rho squared to the 3 halves power minus q prime d for rho squared plus d squared to the 3 halves power has to equal minus epsilon 2 q double prime d over 4 pi epsilon 2 rho squared plus d squared to the 3 halves. That's one key equation we're going to try to solve. Find a q prime and a q double prime that solve this. And we're going to also then demand the E parallel boundary condition, namely minus d phi 1 dx at x, y, 0 has to equal minus d phi 2 dx at x, y, 0, which, sparing you the derivatives, I'll just write it out, 4 pi epsilon 1 times minus qx over rho squared plus d squared to the 3 halves minus q prime x over rho squared plus d squared to the 3 halves is minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon 2 minus q double prime x over rho squared plus d squared to the 3 halves. Okay, it's two equations and two unknowns. Let me spare you the algebra and just give you the solution, or simplified equations. First, that simplifies to q minus q prime equals q double prime, and q plus q prime over epsilon 1 is equal to q double prime over epsilon 2. Just have these two equations and two unknowns, and the solution is q prime. It's minus epsilon 2 minus epsilon 1 over epsilon 2 plus epsilon 1 all times q. And q double prime is 2 epsilon 2 q over epsilon 1 plus epsilon 2. So basically, the short story is that our ansatz worked. You can maybe go through the math yourself if you want. Yeah. Well, the x and y are will be the same, yeah. We just picked one, yeah. There would have been no new information in the y equation. Okay, so I'm out of time. So anyway, I suggest you go through the math a little bit on your own, confirm, because I just kind of skipped all the algebra. But that's the story. I'm sorry this stuff won't be on the exam. I know you're probably sad about that. You'll have later opportunities to demonstrate your understanding. See you at the exam on a week from today. Have a good break. Let me just stop the recording.